Nice song. Crystal Lewis along with Ron Canole. And Beauty for Ashes. We heard from Buddy Green, Fall Down Children, and from Leilani Clark, Keeper of My Heart. Good morning to you. Welcome to a Wednesday here along the Broken Road. I'm Jim Park, and David Allen Punt is with us, as usual. And joining us now from Maryland is Doug Greenwald from Preserving Bible Times. Doug, good morning to you.
Good morning, guys.
Morning, Doug. We're
looking at sunshine outside here. What do you have?
Well, I tell you, I was in Denver yesterday where it was 80 degrees on the weekend, and it snowed and was a high of 35 yesterday. So now I'm back in Maryland where it's, you know, sort of in between.
Well, you got spring out there. I saw pictures from around the D.C. area. There's some cherry blossoms going on out there.
I hope there are at least a few left. Spring really came early here this year.
Well, I guess that's a good thing. But the real trick is, does that mean the winter comes in early too? I mean, does the whole thing shift or just spring?
Who can tell? We don't have enough data yet, but this has certainly been an unseasonable March, and I don't know what's the old April, what is it? April rain, spring May flowers, or what's that old
adage? In like a lion, out like a lamb. That was something like that, yeah. April showers bring May flowers.
Well, you know, we've got March flowers right now. Our tulips are out, our daffodils are out, the hyacinths are out, the forsythia is just about spent. So very unusual.
I spent all my forsythias eons ago. They've been long gone. What's the weather like in Jerusalem these days? Seasonally, I mean, just normally. Is this springtime in Jerusalem?
Well, seasonally, you know, I just came back 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the last day we were there, it snowed. So that'll give you one feel. But I noticed a week later, it was 78 and 80 degrees. So there can be very significant swings there as well. But in general, if you're on the coast these days, it's probably high 70s and high 60s in Jerusalem.
Okay. Well, I was always wondered because I read about Peter warming himself by the fire, and I'd always had this impression that it was almost, I think of Jerusalem as desert and almost subtropical, which is not accurate. But that was my impression. So warming by the fire seemed a little incongruous.
Well, you know, when he's warming himself by the fire, he's in Jerusalem. It's 2,600 feet in the air. It snows in the wintertime there. It is subtropical, but you got to be down in the Jordan Valley for that. And that's 1,100 feet below sea level. So that 4,000-foot differential has a lot to say about your temperature in the wintertime. And that's why we find Jesus teaching in Perea, which is on the eastern side of the Jordan Valley, of the Jordan River, during the wintertime. Because if you're a traveling, popular, itinerant preacher, teacher, rabbi, who's got crowds following you, you don't want to be in Jerusalem in the winter. You want to be in the Palm Springs area in the winter, and that's where we find him.
Well, that makes sense to me. And then he came to Jerusalem. We talked about a Palm Sunday and the symbolism of that and the political atmosphere that surrounded his entry into Jerusalem. We've talked about some of the teaching that he did during that week and the clearing of the temple. But a whole lot more is about to happen here. And if you read scripture, it looks to me like the pressure's starting to get to him. He's really starting to focus now. Accurate?
Well, there's an awful lot going on this week. I would say he's been focused for a long, 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 long time. He knew why he came, but particularly even sharpened the focus when he brought Lazarus back from the dead at the fourth day point. That just sort of sealed the deal that he was going to die. That was an undisputable act that said he truly is Messiah, because the rabbis had decreed that bringing someone back from the dead is so hard it will only happen when Messiah comes. So he knows where he's headed. It hasn't made this week any easier by any stretch of the imagination. And there's an awful lot going on in it. But I thought it might be fun, as well as enlightening, as well as challenging, actually, to reflect on Barabbas for a little bit here this morning. He actually gets more ink in the Gospels than Judas Iscariot does himself. So I think that warrants our paying a little bit more closer attention to him.
Well, Barabbas had inspired a revolution or riots or some sort of civil discord, and he'd been imprisoned, and he was on death row, wasn't he?
He was. In fact, when we put the four Gospels together, we find out he's a robber, he's a murderer, and he's a seditionist. He's a revolutionary. And just to focus on that last phrase for a moment, I think we lose sight of the fact that 6 months before in Rome, Sejanus tried a coup d'etat with the Roman Senate, and Tiberius Caesar got wind of it and crushed it and sent out a decree all throughout the Roman Empire saying, do not tolerate dissent, sedition, rebellion for 1 second. Crush it, kill it, do whatever you have to do. And of course, the Jewish aristocracy is very aware of that. They know that if they go to Pilate with their concern of blasphemy, that from the polytheistic perspective of Rome and Pilate, I mean, that's not even an issue. I mean, we don't prosecute people for that. But they know what Tiberius Caesar has done in the recent past about crushing sedition and revolt. So they hatch a strategy that says, we're going to go to Pilate and we're going to accuse Jesus of being a seditionist. And that for sure will get him killed. That's part of where their thinking comes from.
A light just went on. I've never heard anything outside that story told as part of that story before. But now we're connecting events in Rome and using that to help explain attitudes and the atmosphere.
Strategies.
Yeah, in Jerusalem.
Absolutely. And it forces Pilate's hand because, you know, he's under the jurisdiction of Rome, obviously, as their procreator, and he has to pay attention to any claim of revolt, rebellion, and sedition. So it sort of forces Pilate's hand. And so what we're seeing during Passion Week here, at least toward the latter stages of it, there's a big chess game going on. Different parties are making different moves to accomplish their objectives, and everyone's trying to protect their own self-interest. Pilate, history tells us, has been a pretty bad guy in terms of his governance behavior. Basically, we can view Pilate as on probation from Rome during Passion Week. And so he has to be very careful that he doesn't make one more misstep or his career is going to end. As a matter of fact, a few years later, he does make a misstep and his career does end. So, you know, he has some very valid concerns here. So he can't afford to have a rebellion. So he has to worry about the masses. But he can't afford either to have the Jewish aristocracy and temple leadership turn against him and send a deputation to Rome and complain about his behavior. So he's got to sort of manage them as well. And yet, whatever he does, he has to emerge in such a way that he doesn't take any blame for what happens, because that might also not reflect goodly on him and his performance back in Rome. So that's part of the chess match that's going on during Passion Week.
Now, with Pilate on the hot seat, and his wife plays a role in this, interestingly enough, too. I'm surprised that she gets mentioned, but she does. So apparently, he was in a bit of a quandary, and turned to her for some help, some advice.
Well, I don't go down that road too far, except to make one observation. How do we even know that Pilate had that conversation with his wife? Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, often. How do we know? I think about a lot of things in Scripture that way. How do we know that happened, and who wrote it down at the time?
I don't know, but who was eavesdropping that later reported that back to the gospel writers that allowed them to record it 25 years later? It's just a fascinating
curiosity.
Question.
Yep, it is.
But anyway, so Jesus is brought to Pilate. And Pilate, after a while, finds out that Judas is a Galilean. So consistent with his chess match mentality, he said, that means he's under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas, who indeed is Rome's man up in the Galilean district. I'm going to send him to Antipas because Antipas has already killed John the Baptist, Jesus's cousin, and maybe he'll do me a favor by doing the same thing with Jesus. So off Jesus goes to Herod Antipas.
Well, I never thought of that perspective. Never thought of that perspective, that he was looking to not be responsible for this.
Oh, absolutely. He doesn't want to take the heat for any fallout that might happen here from Jesus' crucifixion. And Herod, of course, is the only person that Jesus said something negative about. Of any person in the Gospels, he calls Herod Antipas a sly fox. Okay? So, and Herod Antipas has been trying to get to see Jesus for quite some time. Jesus actually is centered in Capernaum, which is about 13 miles north of Tiberias, where Herod Antipas hangs out as you walk the seashore. It's a little shorter as the crow flies. And, you know, just as another backstory here, to protect himself politically, in the Galilee district, which is the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas, Jesus, rather shrewdly, I would say, brings back to life the only child, the 12-year-old daughter of the president of the synagogue in Capernaum. His name is Jairus. Mm-hmm. So he buys the allegiance of the top religious man in Capernaum. Then he heals the servant of the centurion in Capernaum and buys the allegiance of the military ruler in Capernaum. And then in another encounter, the royal official goes to Cana to entreat Jesus to heal his rapidly dying son. And Jesus does that as well. And Jesus buys the allegiance of the top Roman administrator in Capernaum. So did you see what Jesus does here?
Well, to see a whole plan. I mean, we read these events in Scripture and we think, oh, isn't that nice? He had a heart for this widow in Nain, or he had a heart for this centurion. But it was all part of the fabric of what he was doing.
Well, he certainly had a heart, but Jesus is certainly capable of doing two or three things at the same time and weaving it together as a strategy. And so, you know, I think some people say, well, Jesus didn't have a political bone in his body as he walked the pages of the New Testament. And I want to say, well, okay, if you want to say he didn't have a political bone in his body, let's at least say he was certainly politically shrewd.
Indeed.
Yeah. So that's just the backstory. In other words, you got to watch out for Tiberius. And Jesus has been watching out for Tiberius. He's want to make sure he doesn't fall within the clutches of Tiberius because he knows what happened to his cousin John the Baptist. So all of that's sort of a backstory to Tiberius now interrogating Jesus in Jerusalem during Passion Week. And of course, Tiberius is politically shrewd. He realizes he doesn't want to get his hands dirty with this.
Now we're talking about Antipas here, Herod, right?
Antipas, yeah. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. This is a hot potato, this Rabbi Yeshua. So after playing some games with him and interrogating him, he sends him back to Pilate. And so Pilate says, well, that move didn't work. Now what in the world am I going to do? So he pauses and thinks for a while and says, right. I've got a great idea. I mean, I really like this one. There's this Jewish tradition during Passover week that I, the Roman procurator, release a prisoner to the masses, to the crowds. And what I will do is I will offer them a choice so starkly different that it will force the crowds to say they want Jesus released, and now I'm out of my dilemma, okay? So who in the world is the worst possible person, the most vile individual I can think of in Israel right now? And hey, wait a minute. There's this guy named Barabbas who's in a cell, even as I speak, most probably in the Antonia Fortress. I'll offer the crowd a choice between Jesus and Barabbas. And what Pilate fails to recognize is if you're going to offer a crowd a choice, you better understand the nature of your crowd. And so we have to make a distinction here. We're talking about a time frame that's very early in the morning, like 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. The masses of pilgrims, the tens of thousands of pilgrims that have come to Jerusalem for Passover are still waking up, are still sleeping. They're the crowd that yelled Hosanna on Palm Sunday, but that's not the same crowd that we're talking about when we're dealing with Pilate's courtyard here. This is a hand-picked group of people, maybe 200, maybe as many as 300, from the cronies of the Sanhedrin and the Jewish aristocracy, and they have been coached and they have been trained to yell, crucify him at a certain point in time, and they've been coached to also yell, give us Barabbas at a certain point in time. So we need to be very clear here, because sometimes we hear a storyline that goes like this. My goodness, how fickle the crowds are. There they are yelling Hosanna on Palm Sunday, and 5 days later they've turned their affections and they're yelling, crucify him towards Jesus. Well, it's not the same crowd at all.
Well, and we see modern day examples of manufactured demonstrations. I think of things coming out of Tehran in Iraq during the war, and it's not unheard of. We should be familiar with such tactics.
Well, even local political campaigns have spontaneous events that are planned.
That's true. We're not afraid to manufacture a crowd for a specific purpose here. Yeah.
Well, you saved me the sarcasm, since I live in Washington, D.C., that every week we have planned spontaneous placards marching on our mall for whatever the subject is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, this is sort of what's going on there. So we need to remember that, and by the way, the word for crowd, in when you translate it, does not mean multitude. It means those who are nearby. And I think that's a very helpful way to understand that word. Those who were nearby in the courtyard of Herod the Great, where Pilate is holding forth, are hand-picked cronies of the Sanhedrin and the Jewish aristocracy, and they've been coached to say what they say and to do what we do.
Just happened to be there at 7 in the morning. Yep, just happened to be wandering by.
Absolutely. And you just don't wander into Herod's palace courtyard.
I wouldn't think so.
You have to be let in. Okay, so that's a backdrop to our story. So Barabbas is absolutely the most worst, vile person that Pilate can think of. He's got this grand strategy of giving this select crowd a choice. Okay. Meanwhile, over in a cell, probably without any light at all, with rats running around the floor, maybe with his limbs chained to the wall, sits Barabbas. Okay? Now, let's focus on him for a moment. What an interesting name.
That name fascinates me.
Yeah, where's his first name?
Well, it's son, Bar, be son of. Oh, where's his first name? Well, the people routinely had just a single name then, didn't they?
I'm not so sure I would say that, because how often don't we find that Simon Bar-Jonah is referenced in the Gospels? Simon, son of Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
So why isn't he Ezekiel Barabbas or Hosea Barabbas?
They didn't know where he came from.
Oh, I'm not so sure. I would say that, but maybe he's so notorious that all you need to say is Barabbas, and everyone knows who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But let's break the word apart, okay? We got Bar, B-A-R, Bar, son of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have we ever seen A-B-B-A-S before, Abbas?
Abba, Father.
Absolutely, in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, our Abba who art in heaven. So we separate these two apart, we have son of Father. Let's put an S behind that. Son of fathers, son of all the fathers. He is the perfect federal man. Now, when I use the word federal man, that's a theological term, but it also comes out of our ways of democratic thinking here. As the federated man, just like Adam was, he's the best possible man to stand in our place. When we talk about Adam being the federated man, he stood for us. He's the best possible person who could have been put in that situation. And when he fell, we fell. And we're directly responsible, just like Adam was. Well, let's look at Barabbas as the perfect federated man. He's the perfect person to represent you and I. We are horrific criminals when the standard is the holiness of God. And so Barabbas is the son of all the fathers, of all the sinful fathers that have ever been. He's the perfect man. He is us. And so I would suggest we really need to identify with him, because just to pull a quote off the shelf from R.C. Sproul, when the holiness of God is the yardstick, the difference between Adolf Hitler and you and I gets lost in the rounding. Are you with me?
I am. So what you're saying is we were all on death row.
Absolutely. And guess what? We have received perfect justice. We have no complaint with the verdict rendered in our case or Barabbas's case at all. As Barabbas sits in his cell, he knows he deserves everything that is shortly to come his way when he gets crucified. He has no complaint. He has no issues whatsoever. He has received perfect justice from the Roman system.
There was a cross reserved for him.
Absolutely. So, as he sits in his cell, he does not have a context for what's going on out there in the streets, okay? Nor in the courtyard at Herod's palace. And so, as he sits in his cell, all of a sudden he hears faintly, "Barabbas, give us Barabbas." And he thinks, "Oh my goodness, I thought I had at least a week to live. Now they want me killed before Passover. I've got a shorter window of time for the rest of my life here than I ever thought." And then a little while later, he faintly hears, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And he thinks, "Oh my goodness, this is going to be my last day. I am down to the last hours of the countdown of my life. I guess I better get resigned to it." And as he continues to sit in the darkness of his cell in the basement of the Antonio Fortress, he hears the shuffling of the jailer coming down, call it death row. And he hears the shuffling feet stopping outside of his cell door, and he hears the key in the lock, and the cell door opens up, and the jailer stands on the threshold of the door, silhouetted against the light in the background because the cell is completely dark, and he says, "Barabbas, you're free." And Barabbas says, "What? You're free? How can that be?" "Well, somebody's taken your place." "Somebody took my place? Who would that be?" "Well, it's a rabbi named Yeshua. I've heard of him. We've all heard of him. Many people think he's Messiah. He's healed people. He's brought them back to life. He showed tremendous compassion in healing people. They say he speaks with an authority like no other. Why in the world is he taking my place?" "I don't know. I'm just here to tell you he did." And so the jailer walks over and undeals the shackles from the legs and the shackles from the arms. And he says, "Get going. Get out of here." And so Barabbas walks through the door. He knows Jerusalem rather well. He knows where Golgotha is. And so he gets out on the streets. He sees the crowds all heading in a certain direction. As best he can, he gets through the crowds and he gets closer and closer. And after a while, he can see Simon of Cyrene carrying the crossbeam that Jesus was supposed to carry. But because he's been defleshed and the muscles of his backs have been removed, he has no control over his shoulders. So he needs someone to carry the crossbeam. He follows him up to Calvary or Golgotha. He sees him lay Jesus on the ground and nail his hands into the crossbeam. Then he sees them lift the crossbeam up onto the vertical beam, and then he sees them mount that, and then they take his legs and they scrunch them up together and they pound nails on both of his heels into the big vertical cross piece. And he watches the blood come out and he watches the pain and he says, "That is supposed to be me. I can't believe he took my place." And he's absolutely mesmerized as he watches the cross. He stands there. He watches Jesus slowly die. He hears the centurion say, "Surely this is the Son of God." He's there when darkness comes over Jerusalem at noon and stays until 3. And eventually he walks away. And I've often wondered, what did that do to Barabbas? Being set free, having Jesus taken his place, what did that ever do to him? None of us know. When we get to glory, that's going to be one of my first questions. You know, is Barabbas in the West Wing here or is he not? But now, push the rewind button on this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the cell. Barabbas is sitting on a plank and he's chained with his legs and his arms and it's totally darkness. And he hears the shuffle of the jailer's feet, and the cell door swings open, and the jailer says, "Barabbas, you're free." And Barabbas says, "I'm not interested. I'm going to stay right here." No, Barabbas, you're free. You can go. Someone's taking your place. "I don't care. I prefer just to stay here in my cell, chained, and wait to die." And the jailer says, "You've got to be kidding me. That's totally irrational. Nope, I'm not interested in being free. Let me die." And you know what? Tens of thousands of people every day make that very decision. They hear that Jesus has come to set them free. As he said in Luke 4, "I have come to set the prisoners free." He has come to take their place, to take upon him their sins and bring them to that cross and pay the price. And people say, "You know, I'm not interested. I'd rather be in prison to sin, and I'd rather be in my chains than to ever be set free." An amazing decision, an incredibly bad decision, but it happens every day, and that's why I think Barabbas is just an absolutely fascinating person.
A much bigger story than ever has been taught to me in church. David?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the play that I was in, The Centurion, a couple of years ago, when I was in in the church in Baxter. And the Barabbas's part in it is incredibly short. The crowd yells for him. He shows up, and now that I think about it, I'm not even sure if he has lines in the play. But that just kind of mirrors the teachings that I remember from a lifetime in Christian churches.
And the story he's as powerful an example of the basic decision we're all asked to make.
Yeah.
Than I ever would have considered.
And he is one of the pivotal points in the whole thing as it relates directly to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's given such short shrift. Interesting. Do you have any thoughts about why it's given such short shrift, Doug?
Well, I would say because we really aren't fans of context. We really haven't dug into the rest of the story. So we're content with a one-dimensional Western understanding of Passion Week rather than to dig in and fathom the three-dimensional Middle Eastern Jewish village understanding of what all this stuff means. So it's like a lot of passages that we have dealt with before. You can understand them at a one-dimensional level or you can fathom them at a three-dimensional level. And when you get to the three-dimensional contextual restored version of these narratives, they take your breath away. They're tremendously challenging, and at the same time, they're tremendously comforting because we see the rest of the story.
I remember when the movie, the Mel Gibson's movie came out, Passion of the Christ, and it was one of the highest grossing movies of that particular year, and people who had not seen movies ever came into the theaters to watch this particular movie. And I remember how uncomfortable it made so many people. I mean, not the ones who saw it, but the ones who had heard about it and heard about this very, very well telling of this particular story and the graphic pain and the graphic violence that was shown in the movie and how uncomfortable people were because of it.
Two observations. There was a lot of complaint about the violence and the blood in that movie, and my reaction was, it's not bloody enough.
Yeah, it was probably a little Disney-fied, yeah.
And the other reaction I had is, folks, you've just seen a 24-hour slice here of the Passion of Jesus. If you could see all 40 days leading up to Passion Week, it would take your breath away. Mm-hmm. So we have to realize that what Mel Gibson does is just one snapshot of Passion Week.
Yeah, I remember sitting in the theater afterwards, and usually, when you get up from a movie, you talk amongst yourselves and your friends, and you look at other people, and it maybe even talk to other people, but not in the theater that I was in.
Can you imagine if Mel Gibson had played up appropriately the role of Barabbas in his movie,
right?
And then people could literally walk away and say Barabbas was me.
Yeah,
what the power that would have been.
Yeah, and I don't remember the movie now. As far as how big Barabbas's role was in, and it wasn't very large.
I don't remember him being there at all. I have no idea how he was represented in that movie.
Well, I think I remember the order given that he be set free, and then maybe a close up of somebody unlocking a gate, and then you saw his back. And you saw him escaping into the crowd, which is kind of an interesting symbol by itself.
Doug, Easter is Sunday, and of course Friday is Good Friday, and Thursday is Maundy Thursday. There are a lot of events yet in Passion Week to come, and you've got an explanation, an elucidation of Jesus' last words. I would love to hear. Do you have time to do that?
I do. You mean this week or Thursday?
Right now.
Oh, right now?
Yeah.
It's probably 15 or 20 minutes.
Well, we can do it if you can. Because we won't hear from you again until next week.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, please.
In Matthew, at about the noontime hour, in that noon to 3 o'clock time frame, a lot has been written and said on the last seven words of Jesus. I would like to focus on two of them. The first one is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And there's two ways to look at those nine words. One is from a Western perspective, and one is from a Middle Eastern Hebrew perspective. The first thing that should strike us about what Jesus said is what he didn't say. So, for example, what Jesus did not say is, my Father, why have you forsaken me? He did not say, my God, why have you abandoned me? What he has done is precisely state Psalm 22:1 as it's recorded in the Old Testament scriptures. Mm-hmm. Now, that should really cause us to stop and think. Why did Jesus precisely state Psalm 22:1? It even gets more intriguing when we get to the last words of Jesus in John, where he says, it is finished, or it is accomplished, because in the original construction of Psalm 22, that's the exact last phrase of Psalm 22. It is finished, it is accomplished. So what Jesus is doing is reciting the first and last verses, or phrases, if you will, of Psalm 22. To the Jewish worldview, that is tremendously significant. Now, I got to go off on a cul-de-sac here for a moment and teach you about a first century Jewish rabbinic teaching genre called Remez, R-E-M-E-Z. It's to hearken back to something that everyone knows and understands, and for which no further explanation is needed. You see, when everyone has memorized most of their Old Testament scriptures, which is true in the first century in observant Judaism, you can speak in shorthand because everyone knows the longhand meaning. Jesus uses remez, which is a powerful argument that he may well be intending his last words to be understood that way, because he walks through Luke periodically and refers to himself as the Son of Man. That's a deliberate remez, a deliberate hearkening back to Daniel 7, where everyone knows where the fuller description of the Son of Man is given. Last week we talked about Palm Sunday. The donkey is a remez back to both Solomon and to Zechariah 9:9. The palm branches are remezes back to the coins that the Hasmoneans minted in about 140 BC with palm branches on it. So this is a very standard way of thinking. This is a very standard way of communicating. We communicate this way in our own culture. If I say to you, Jim, 9/11, what comes to your mind?
The Twin Towers.
Terrorist attack. Pictures, mm-hmm. And fears, and concerns, mm-hmm. And anxiety, and smoke, and all kinds of stuff. Down in Texas, they have a little three-word remez called Remember the Alamo. Okay, mm-hmm. So we're familiar with this way of communicating a lot with a very few words. So I would suggest to you that Jesus, as he has almost down to his last breath, does not have energy to have a long final prayer, a long benediction, a long final statement. By uttering Psalm 22:1 and the very last phrase of Psalm 22, he deliberately intends it to be understood as a remez, as invoking all of Psalm 22. Because the way this remez system works here is any portion of a portion is the whole portion. All I have to do is bring in any piece of a larger narrative, and everyone knows I'm talking about the whole narrative itself. Mm-hmm. Okay? Well, isn't that something? If you read Psalm 22 from Jesus' perspective, tremendous specificity in how Messiah is supposed to die. It says Jesus is saying, I identify with Psalm 22. It will reveal and explain and show you exactly what is happening to me. And then, a couple years ago, we heard from some scholars in Jerusalem that a better way to think about the Jewish worldview in the first century is that Psalms 22, 23, and 24 would have been seen as a unitized whole, that those three Davidic Psalms have to be understood as if they're all together. If that's true, then by invoking Psalm 22:1 and powerfully underscoring that the intent here is to be a remez by also putting the very last phrase, it is finished, of Psalm 22, might Jesus well be invoking all of Psalms 22, 23, and 24 as his final statement. Mm-hmm. I would suggest on Good Friday, read those three Psalms together from Jesus' perspective. It mm-hmm. will take your breath away. Mm-hmm. Psalm 23, expresses his confidence that his Father will be with him through this process. Lo, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, though thou art with me. Psalm 24 expresses his return to glory. Throw open the gates of heaven, the King of glory returns. All of this fits beautifully as a sequence and as a logic. Now, why is this important to think Jewish in a literary genre of the first century when we deal with the last words of Jesus? Because it gives us another way of understanding how to interpret those words. Because from a Western perspective, if we don't deal with the Jewish literary technique of communication, we Westerners look at my God, why have you forsaken me as just that. We don't connect it to Psalm 22:1. We say, my goodness, it must be that God forsook him. That's exactly what the words say. And then we do a very creative thing here. We somehow remove the word forsake and we insert the word abandon. Now, you can't do that, but that's what's happened. And so we then are left with, there is God who looks upon his Son and sees all the sin of the world ever was, ever will be, and is. It's such a hideous sight. He turns his back on his only Son, breaks the fellowship of the Trinity, and that's the real pain of Calvary. Now, setting aside that God has a back, I mean, I think that's just an anthropomorphic projection that we Westerners put in there. We certainly have to also deal and keep our theology straight here, that we cannot break up the oneness, the eternal essence of the Trinity, not for a nanosecond. Can't split that apart. So I won't go down the theological implications of that. But do you see here how looking at the last words of Jesus, particularly as we see it in John and Matthew, from the perspective of how Jewish rabbis and Jewish teachers communicated with each other in the first century with their disciples, how you can look at this very, very differently? And make my final observation here. The word forsake, my God, why have you forsaken me, comes from the Psalms. Therefore, I would suggest it has to be defined by how it's used in the Psalms. And when you do a contextual analysis of wherever you find the word forsake in the Psalms, what you find is the definition of forsake is, why have you let me fall into the hands of mine enemies for whatever your purposes are until you decide to release me? And that's exactly what has just happened to Jesus. God has allowed him to fall into the hands of his enemy until God's purposes have been completed. And so that's a very, very different understanding of the word forsake. It has nothing to do with God removing his presence, okay? I mean, I have really compressed here a 30-minute explanation, probably down into 7 or 8 minutes here. But I hope you've gotten a sense, there is a very different way to look at the last words of Jesus that from an interpretation point of view takes us to a rather different place.
And a way that makes sense in the bigger picture. I mean, you know, I've always been taught what you had just explained, that God turned his back on his Son. That never set right with me. Felt like that belonged as part of the story.
A lot of pieces of that don't hold together. What do you mean God can't look upon sin? I mean, he's looking at sin every moment of every day. He goes eyeball to eyeball with his adversary, the devil, in Job. He looks evil square in the eye. What God cannot do is countenance sin or approve of sin, but he's looking at sin all the time because there's sin all around us here in this world.
Doug, it's amazing. As always, we're grateful to you for enlightening us and bringing this different perspective to us. It's so critical. I just wish we could reach the whole world with this program this morning and let them hear this. It's so important to get it right because it's such a big thing.
Such tremendous pastoral implications. Mm. God will not turn his back on you. He will not lead you. Okay, he will always be with you, you his lambs, you his children. Okay, the assurance that comes out of that and the comfort that comes out of that.
We're talking with Doug Greenwald. Preserving Bible Times is his ministry in the Washington, D.C. area, and he teaches the historic and cultural context of Scripture and thereby makes it not palatable, but understandable and adds the power that's there that most of us just miss. And we're grateful to you. You might want to visit the website, because the website and the organization Preserving Bible Times is a wonderful asset for churches and Bible studies and small groups and discussions. And you learn a whole lot, I guarantee you. There's nobody that provides more aha moments to us than Doug Greenwald. Doug, shalom. Have a blessed Easter, and we'll look forward to speaking with you next Wednesday morning.
Shalom, shalom, guys.
Music on A Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning from Lauren Mulrain.
I am the author of the ages.